I was terrified that I would be ostracized from my community because of how Sam had died. And what I found was actually the opposite. I found that because I was just very honest and transparent about the fact that Sam had died by suicide, people were really drawn to having those conversations. It is stunning to me how many people have a very close connection to having lost someone to suicide, but we don't talk about it. That's why it's stunning to me, even though now I know the statistics. And suicide's the 10th leading cause of death in this country, but we don't like to talk about it. But talking about it is what makes a difference. So I just kind of learned that by talking about it.
Well, everybody, welcome back to Success Rewritten. I'm your host, Emily Lomenzo Washkovic, and today's conversation is with author Charlotte Maya. I'm so honored to have her here today. This book alone is an amazing resource for anyone who's navigating loss, but it really is so special for the topic of suicide and suicide loss. For everyone listening today, we do have some other episodes that they can dig into, but I'm just so grateful that you wanted to share your journey and talk about it. And I'm excited for people to hear more about what this has looked like for you and how it can help people, whether they're struggling or they know someone in their life that they think is struggling. I'm just honored that you're here. So thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for hosting me, because talking about suicide is the number one thing that helps. And so hosting this conversation is everything.
I feel like we can just jump right in, because that's how I felt when I read this book. I mean, I already knew that you had lost your husband, Sam, and I wasn't sure when I picked up the memoir. I'm like, where are we going to start, you know? And it starts that first day. Can we just start there and have you tell us a little bit about Sam and then also this event that happened in 2007?
Yeah. Sam and I had been married for 15 years. We met in law school, and Sam was funny and kind. He was the kind of dad who would leave work early to go to parent-teacher conferences. He coached the kids' Little League games, or their t-ball. I guess they were really little. They were t-ball games. And, you know, he was kind and warm and funny. He was the guy who would like sit in the back row and crack jokes just to the person next to him. He wasn't like the class clown in the big way. He was kind of subtle and sly and very funny. And, you know, we were clipping along in what I thought was a beautiful and was a beautiful little life. And I had taken the kids to soccer, and because, you know, they were 6 and 8. And Sam was really tired. And so he was going to stay home and take a nap. And when we got home later that day, Sam's car was missing from the front of the house, but there was a police car in front. And I thought that was weird. And when I pulled into the driveway, there was a policeman, a policewoman, and a priest standing in the driveway. And I knew that was not going to be good news. One of my kids once drew a picture of the day that his father died. And on one half of the page was blue sky and flowers and a little frog. And then he drew a line down the center of the page and just scribbled black on the opposite side of the page. And that is kind of what that day felt like.
I think the thing that's so profound about your book is the ability to look back at what happened and talk about how it felt and what you knew but also didn't know. And I think unless someone has lost someone to suicide, they don't understand all of the questions and the searching and the seeking that you're going through when you experience a loss like that. How do you feel like that has helped you with sharing and navigating and understanding? Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me like that is just where you were driven, is like not like you were going to get all the answers, but like you were going to get into the feelings and the emotions. And maybe it was because you had your young boys. I mean, I'm trying to like ask this the perfect way, but
you can ask it the imperfect way.
I think I have to. Yeah. I think the question is, how did you reconcile what you were feeling in that moment? And then also how you now talk about it in a way that honors that, but also has progress as a part of it. Because that's something about your storytelling to me is it never stays in the past. It honors what it was, but then it moves forward. Yeah.
I feel like I want to answer this question in two parts. And one is sort of talking about what happened, and the other is talking about the craft of writing about what happened.
There we go.
Which is a different aspect.
It is.
So when the police came to let me know of Sam's suicide, they told me, we will tell the children that their father died, but you have to tell them how. And we recommend that you tell them the truth because you do not want them to find out from somebody else. And on a day when nothing made sense, that actually made sense to me. So I gathered the children in one chair. We fit in one chair then, and I told them that their father had taken his own life. And it's the hardest thing I've ever done. But I am grateful for that advice from those first responders because my kids know they can count on me for honest answers to really hard questions. And sometimes the honest answer is, I don't know. I'm the little one in the family now. They're 6'2 and 6'3. But that level of honesty and transparency really guided my journey forward. I was terrified that I would be ostracized from my community because of how Sam had died. And what I found was actually the opposite. I found that because I was just very honest and transparent about the fact that Sam had died by suicide, people were really drawn to having those conversations. It is stunning to me how many people have a very close connection to having lost someone to suicide, but we don't talk about it. That's why it's stunning to me, even though now I know the statistics. And suicide's the 10th leading cause of death in this country, but we don't like to talk about it. But talking about it is what makes a difference. So I just kind of learned that by talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible to me. Like Sam died on a Saturday, and I took the kids to school on Monday, and their teachers knew what happened. And I told the kids, you know, last as long as you can and call me when you need to come home. So I dropped them each off. And then when I was leaving the elementary school, and there's this big lawn, and I was walking across, I started to walk across the lawn, and I was met with this wall of hugs, like just people I didn't know. And that to me sort of epitomizes what happened for me in this journey when I was very honest about what happened. Not all the parents at the elementary school were super excited that I told my children the truth. To be fair. And then sometimes the kids would come home with these crazy stories about how their father would had died. And again, I was able to just, you know, they knew they could come to me for honest answers. They knew I would tell them the truth. And so that really informed my experience. And I didn't entirely set out to be a writer. There's a part of me that really that wanted to write.
Before this happened.
Yes. Right. And in fact, the kids were in first and third grades. And it was, as a mom, it was going to be the first time that both kids were in school for the same time every day. So that was kind of exciting. It's not a long time, just, you know, 4 or 5 hours, but that's gold in mommy hours. And so I knew I was going to write, but it's funny to me now. I can't for the life of me figure out what I thought I was going to write about.
I think that's hysterical.
This was not what I intended to write about. But as I was just really honest with people and sharing my story, people started telling me, you have to write the book. You have to write the book. you have to write the book. I was like, book's kind of a big deal. And several years after Sam had died, I thought, well, a book feels too daunting, but maybe I'll start with a blog. And so the title of the book, Sushi Tuesdays, comes from Tuesdays were my day for self-care. And sometimes I would go to yoga and I would go to therapy. And sometimes I would take myself out to lunch and sometimes I would go to sushi. And the kids were little. They were 6 and 8, so they did not care about sushi.
Yeah.
And I did not make plans to meet. Meet anyone.
No plans.
No coffee.
No one expecting you.
No attorneys. No doctors. No CPAs. Nobody, just me and whatever I needed for my own healing. Because, you know, when you're a single mom with two young kids, I knew I had to take care of myself so that I could take care of everybody else. And so Tuesdays became, I first called them my Charlotte Shabbat.
Which I thought, like, was awesome. I love that.
It's my sacred day for self healing and I for self-care. And I looked forward to Tuesdays more than Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays. Tuesdays were it. And it very quickly my friends became aware, like, I didn't go for hikes with them, I didn't meet them for coffee, I didn't even want to chat with them on the phone. That was like my little cocoon. And sometimes I would take myself out for sushi, party of one. And so Sushi Tuesdays became the name of the blog. Can I use the, your listeners won't be able to see this, but on video you will. So I had always pictured the book eventually like this, Sushi Tuesdays above the title, but in URL form, Sushi Tuesdays, there's one of what we call Uncle Jose's colorful words. Right? Can I say it?
Yes.
Because once you see it, you can't unsee it. There's shit right in the middle of Sushi Tuesdays.
Oh, so smart.
Well, I wish I could take credit for it. That was sort of accidental. But once I saw it, because one of my friends said, did you know there's shit in the middle of your Sushi Tuesdays? And I was like, that's perfect.
It's
poetic.
Yeah.
Because what the blog was about was dealing, grief is messy. And the blog was about dealing with the real mess of what life post a suicide looks like.
Right.
It wasn't always pretty. And so I really liked that there was then shit in the middle of my Sushi Tuesdays.
Yeah.
So that's where the title comes from, is Sushi Tuesdays. That was my day for self-care. And so I started the blog, and after, I would post on Tuesdays. And after several years, I printed out all the blog posts and I had a big fat notebook worth of blog posts, but they didn't really tell a cohesive story because, you know,
different thoughts, different days,
different days. Yeah. And in the blog, for example, I could just say my friend, blah, 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 blah. But in a book, that doesn't really make sense. You kind of have to know who the friend is. Maybe they have a name.
Yeah.
And
if you had used everyone's name, I would have had a character web for myself that would have been so long.
Well, yes, because like we were talking about community, one of the things that happened to me is there were so many people who reached out for help. And I think that everybody has their own sort of quality of light that they shine in this world. And a ton of people shined their light in my world in a way that just was incredible and helpful and healing. But I couldn't include everybody by name in the book. But I wanted readers to understand how many different ways you can help somebody in grief. And one of the ways is just showing up with that thing you do that you're really good at. I'll just read just a little bit.
Yeah.
When you multiply a family of four by one suicide, the ensuing calculus of grandparents, siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins, and in-laws requires an abacus, a consanguinity chart, and several religious texts. Add friends, neighbors, colleagues, community connections, and well-intentioned onlookers, and then it becomes downright unruly. It was amazing to me how people I didn't know well or even at all stepped up to help. Some had a unique skill or special access. Others had shared experiences, useful perspectives, or simply a broken heart. Everyone possessed their own quality of light that they shined in my world. These lovely people made cameo appearances and long-term commitments to the well-being of my sons and me in ways I could never have imagined. I am profoundly grateful. I won't name each individually, not because they aren't desperately dear to me, but because there were so many. In the interest of clarity, therefore, I will call them collectively the Janes. And so I had a team of Janes, Engineer Jane, Entrepreneur Jane, Artist Jane, Dr. Jane. And so that is how, as a craft perspective, the craft of writing, I was able to incorporate all of these amazing people and moments into a book that then would make sense for readers.
Well, and I never even thought about it as a way to give examples of how people can support. But as soon as you just said that, I'm like, oh yeah, I was interpreting different examples while I was reading that. And if you had called them by their individual name instead of naming them as a unique thing that gets added to something that they all identify as, that is such a great way to share the story, make it still centered around your experience, and give some educational guidance to your reader.
Like, yes,
it's not just here how my life was, it's actually hear all of the different ways that people supported us, held us, so that you're aware of what that can look like.
Exactly.
Something that I really thought was just, it's like an of course, but also, how would you know if you didn't live it? When you first were experiencing this loss, you had to put your sons first. I mean, what they were experiencing was truly the priority.
Yes.
And you were not grieving yourself from your own lens for a while because you were trying to prioritize what they needed in that moment of grief. Would you describe it that way or a little different?
I think it is kind of like that, but there's also like grief is physical.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't sleep for 3 days. Dr. Jane, by the way, showed up on my doorstep with a prescription for Xanax. And that was the first time I slept in 3 days. And sleep is key to the healing process as well. So there's kind of two aspects. There's suicide prevention, which is so important, but there's also suicide postvention, because we will sometimes lose people we love and cannot live without to suicide. And it is helpful to have suicide is a very complicated death from which to continue to heal, because the person that you love and can't live without is also the person you are so pissed at. Like I had a lot of feelings. And so to say that I don't feel like I put my grief on hold. I just, sometimes I had to kind of give it a back seat while I gave the children a front seat. But that's part of why it's so messy. And when you have three grieving people, and you know, I'm the adult in the room, so I had to, I guess I didn't have to, but it was important to me. It was very important to me that I was able to hold my children in all of their feelings. And sometimes they were enraged and sometimes they were bereft and sometimes they didn't want to think about it because they're 6 and 8 years old. And sometimes they would break big rocks into little rocks. And, you know, I just tried to let them lead.
They had very different needs, very different yes. ways of processing the loss. And this is when they were younger, but you share so much of what that looked like for each yeah. of them. Can you just expand on it? Because I think especially for anyone supporting a grieving child, you don't know what that's going to look like. And yeah. I think as humans, we're always looking for normal, and there isn't.
There isn't.
So talk to us about what it looked like for your sons, because the dichotomy I thought was so interesting.
Yeah, it's, children come as they are, mm-hmm. and they will teach you what they need if you're paying attention. So mm-hmm. I think you pay attention to your children mm-hmm. and you see what they need. And so one of the kids constantly wanted to talk about daddy. And one of them would not say what we called the D words, dead or daddy, for years. And so it was tricky. to navigate when one wants to talk about daddy and the other doesn't want to talk about daddy. And so, you know, I tried to do my best. And sometimes we just have to let ourselves be our imperfect best and show up the best we can. And so sometimes the one who didn't want to talk about daddy would get the puppy and or snacks, or, you know, and the one who did want to talk about daddy, we would whisper about daddy so that the other didn't hear. I don't know. I just tried to be as creative and present as I could possibly be. I learned very quickly to prioritize stuff. Like if a lot of stuff got broken.
I was going to mention that. Like when I was reading that, I'm like, oh my gosh. But then when you got to the point where you're saying, like, if they're safe, who gives a shit?
Who gives? Right.
And that's a really good way to look at it.
Right. Are they safe? Are they hurting themselves? Are they hurting somebody else? Okay. Then you know what? The Lego spaceship is going to break. That's just what it is. And if it goes flying into different pieces, or the favorite blanket that was shredded. Oh God. I know. Horrible.
And then they're like, Mom, put it back together. Just brutal. I mean, brutal. And so you gave great examples in here, and I'm sure they're just examples. Like, you know, kids say the darndest things. Well, talk about kids say the darndest things after their dad dies by suicide. I mean, they would just hit you with stuff
totally
out of nowhere.
Well, you learn to reprioritize things, right? I mentioned Uncle Jose's colorful words. And we talked about, so the kids heard a lot of words at daddy's funeral and right around the time daddy died that they had never heard before. So we talked about what all those words were and what they meant. And, you know, and I told them, sometimes we use little words for big feelings, and that is okay. I said, that having been said, I can't save you from the principal if you use them at school. So maybe don't say them at school. Yeah. But you can say them at home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were home one day and my then 6-year-old was out in the backyard breaking big rocks into little rocks and comes back in, he slams the door. He's like, Mommy, what's for fucking dinner? He had his little hands on his hips and it's so stinking funny. I wanted to laugh because it's so cute. But then also, like, this is a kid in pain. And so I just like took a deep breath and I'm like, fucking mac and cheese. I mean, I just had to follow their lead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm the mother of the year.
I mean, when I was, every time I'm like, God, she's just so good at pausing and addressing their needs, And that's like just mom city. I mean, the way that you emotionally regulated yourself before helping them, I mean, it's something that people struggle with even when they're not going through a tragedy, you know? So to see that at work, you should be proud of yourself.
I had a really good therapist.
You had a whole slew of therapists on the payroll. Let's talk about that. I mean, God, it was like,
we had his, hers, theirs, ours. We had all the therapists.
But that helped so much. Just a common language between the three of you, you and your boys.
Yeah.
Something that I wanted to talk about is there's this, like, after Sam passed, like, you were almost waiting to find out the why. Like, mm-hmm. was there a woman? Mm-hmm. Did he, like, lose our money some way? Can you take me back to that? Because I think, obviously, that's where so many brains go. Yeah. And then you're faced with like, oh, that actually wasn't what was happening, which is great. Not like you wanted to find out about some mistress, but that
I really could have been pissed then, though.
Well, right. Yeah. And it would have been like, oh, well, that's why. Like, it would have solved the why of it all that we're so distracted by.
Well, yeah, because it would have been nice to have somebody to blame that wasn't me.
Right. Right.
Although I did that, too. I think that's one of the things that's so complicated about suicide. It's so, like, I just took on a lot of that myself. I think that's pretty common. It's very hard to live with the unknown. And there's certainly a sense in which I'll never know.
Right.
Because the one person who might have access to those answers is now gone. I don't like living in the unknown. So it's very uncomfortable. Now I can look back and go, you know, I'm glad that he hadn't, you know, put all the chips on red.
Right.
I'm glad he hadn't had an affair. I'm desperately sad that he was in so much pain, physical and mental pain. I knew about the physical pain. I didn't understand the mental pain. I can look back now in retrospect and see things that were, that can be signs. I knew he was struggling with something, but I didn't know what it was. I thought it was the back pain. I thought it was job stress. But you know, if you have a job, you have job stress. If you don't have a job, then you really have job stress. I mean, like it seemed like normal.
Well, and he didn't know. How could you know? He couldn't tell you, right?
I mean, well, he didn't tell me. Could he have told me?
I don't know. I guess I didn't think about that.
That's one of the questions I don't.
Right.
Right. I don't know. And I didn't ask. So for example, one of the things, my training is as an attorney. Mm-hmm. And in one of the ironies of this situation, it was a trust and estate attorney. Mm-hmm. So I did all wills and trusts and probates. And mm-hmm. so I read wills and trusts all the time and I didn't really give it a second thought.
Right.
It's just like, to me, it's not that boring. And so he had, the night before he died, he had our will and trust out on the counter. And it didn't strike me as alarming because I had been thinking about revising it. Because it said everything we have, blah, 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 goes to Danny and any other children we might have in equal shares. Well, then we had Jason.
Right.
And so I wanted to revise our trust so that it included both children by name. So I assumed that he had it out on the counter for the same reason that I would have had it out on the counter, which is to look at it with an eye toward revising it. And Sam, by the way, we met in law school, so he was also a lawyer. So it didn't strike me as especially odd in context. Now I know that reviewing a will or trust or other document related to your death can be a red flag
right.
for suicidal behavior. But I didn't know that then. So sometimes people say, well, weren't there any signs? Now that I know what some of the signs are, yes, there were some of the signs. He had lost a little weight over the summer, but 5 pounds. Who doesn't want to lose 5 pounds, especially when you're in your 40s? Like, I don't know anybody who doesn't want to lose just a couple pounds. So there were things.
The thing I hate about the were there signs is I feel like that puts the onus or the pressure on the family member. Like, the assumption of that question is, why didn't you save them? I hate to be blunt,
yeah.
but and people don't. They're not asking it with that in mind, but that's how I feel that. And I'm not even the one experiencing it, but it's like you're instantly, as the one who's still here, asked to explain. And it's like, no one explained it to me. So then you're trying to put things together, but it's so hard to say, like, you should have noticed.
I agree with you. And also, we know, I feel like suicide literacy is something that we as a culture can do better.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way that we know about nutrition and things that are good for us and like smoking is bad for us, I think we can learn to be a little bit more suicide literate. Mm-hmm. And so it can be helpful to know some of those signs.
Yes.
But it, for me, they all sort of boil down to, is your person off? Do you feel like something is going on? And then it's okay to ask. Because what the research shows is that if you ask somebody if they are thinking about suicide, that doesn't plant the idea in their head that wasn't already there. What that does instead is it opens up a space for you to have a conversation. And that's what I hadn't done, that I wish I had done. Instead of assuming that he had it out, what if I had asked? Because I didn't ask him.
Mm-hmm.
What if I had? Oh, hey, I was thinking about looking that. Why did you have it out? Now, his job would have been to tell me.
Right.
So, I don't know. One of the things my therapist used to say all the time is you're 100% responsible for your 50%. You don't get to own his 50%. You just get to own your own 50%. And turns out that's enough.
It's a lot.
It's a big load. Job.
It's a load.
So, I don't know. I just think there are just a few things that we in general can do better that are very easy. And one is learning to ask.
I love how you said about if they feel off, like you don't even maybe need to know what that off is, but it's different to you. And opening the door in a way that isn't like accusatory, but curious, I think.
Exactly.
And I mean, you know, you could do the laundry list of these are some typical signs, but it's going to be different for different people based on what their baseline is or what normal looks like for them. Something that I found interesting in how you like share the story in hindsight is you don't really glaze over the fact that you are still mad sometimes. It doesn't mean you're always mad at Sam, but you're pissed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I still have moments. I think I will always have moments. Mm-hmm. Most of them are related to when the children are suffering.
Of course.
So I wish I could tell you that the children don't still suffer. They do, because this is a lifelong journey. And they are going to think about it at every funeral they ever go to. And they are going to think about it when they are older than Sam ever got to be.
Yep.
He was 41, which seemed young at the time and now seems crazy young. But it is a high-risk demographic. 40s and 50s, especially for men, is a high-risk demographic. They are going to think about it again when they have their own children. And they're never not going to think about it. And so when they struggle, those are the times when I am still mad.
Yeah.
And it doesn't last as long as it used to. Mm. It doesn't stick around for so long. Yeah. It's, you know, I can find my sense of humor again pretty quickly. Yeah. One of my friends who went to college together, and I had forgotten that his father had died by suicide until after Sam died by suicide. I was like, oh, I need to talk to Kirk. And Kirk was 10 and his brother was 8 when their father died by suicide. And so he gave me some very good perspective. And one of the things he said is, listen, Charlotte, grief is like a heavy sandbag at your feet. And if you don't pick it up, it will trip you for the rest of your life. But when you pick it up, you will notice that there's a little hole in the bottom. And that's where the grains of sand start to fall out. And then two things happen. One is you get stronger. And two, it gets lighter. And so I feel like that's the case with the anger. Like, I still sometimes feel that sandbag and it is full of rage. But I'm really good now at doing that heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it when people say time heals all wounds. I don't think time heals anything by itself. But what time does do is it gives you the opportunity to do the work. Mm. And so when I did the work, I got stronger. And so the anger will come. The sadness will come. It's been 19 years, and sometimes it feels like 19 years, and sometimes it feels like 19 minutes. Like just that moment will be like breathtaking. So I think it's just about learning to do the work.
I want to talk about love. I mean, I don't want to give away the book, but it does wrap so long ago that we can. I guess I want to start with the fact that you thought you were never going to, I mean, you had no interest in dating, but it is odd how many people just start like coming out of the woodwork. Like, oh, you don't have a husband anymore. Suddenly there's like all these single dads at school. Yeah.
That wanted to meet for coffee.
Gross.
Except for none of them wanted to meet for coffee. Yeah, it was gross.
It is gross. Come on.
Well, you know, when Sam died, we had been together for 17 years and we'd been married for 15. And I wanted more, but I was also grateful. Mm. I had been loved. I'd been loved for who I was. And I felt grateful. And it ended too soon. But, you know, then I was a single mom with two little kids, so I was too busy for coffee or anything else. I had no intention of falling in love again. But one of the kids, one of the kids had said, "Mommy, I need you to get married again because I need a stepdaddy because I'm too little to be the man of the house."
You're like, who do I need to go strangle?
Yeah.
Who told this kid?
Where do I start? You're not the man of the house. You're the 8-year-old of the house. Your job is third grade. Do your homework. Play dates. Maybe brush your teeth. Yeah. Personal hygiene. It's real. And predictably, the other said, "Mommy, I don't want you ever to get married again because nobody will ever be as good as daddy. And if you marry that guy, I'm going to kill him. And then I'm going to kill his ghost. And then I'm going to kill his ghost ghost." So the kid had feelings. And I told you, we let all the feelings. But it really hadn't occurred to me that I was single until the kids and I were having this conversation. Oh. And what I said to them then, and which is still true very much to me today, is, listen, there's a daddy-shaped space in your heart that will be there forever. No one is ever going to take over that space because nobody else fits. But the thing about love is that if we do meet somebody special, there will be a new place just for him. And doesn't take over the daddy space. It will be its own thing. And I wanted to hold that for the children. But meanwhile, in the back of my head, I'm like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I guess the short story is a friend of mine set us up. She was a really good friend. She continues to be a really good friend. And she knew this guy, and his wife had died from colon cancer, and he'd had 2 kids. And she'd be like, "He's just a nice guy." I'm like, "Do not give him my number." I'm sure he's just a nice guy, whatever. Yeah. And she's like, "Oh yeah, yeah." She played it real cool. And around Mother's Day, so Sam died in October, and Mother's Day the next year, 2008, was the first day I didn't cry. Mm. And I was having a really good day, all about me. My parents spoiled me and my kids spoiled me. I did not cry until I thought about this man I did not know and his 2 kids on their first Mother's Day without mom. And I just started weeping, and I sent my friend a note, said, "Listen, tell your friend Tim that I imagine Mother's Day completely sucks and there are people who care." And she tags back, "Okay if I give him your number?" And so clearly I wasn't thinking straight because I said yes. A couple days later, I'm standing on the back steps of the dojo because the kids were taking karate.
Yeah.
And they're doing their final bows or whatever, and the phone rings, and it's a Pasadena area code, and I think it might be work, so I answer, and this very nice voice says, "Hi, it's Tim Stratz. Am I calling at an okay time?" And I said, "No."
I love that. I was reading that on the plane. I just started cracking up. I'm like, of course. She's like, "Nope, it's not good.
Not a good time." I said, "Can you call me later?" And he said, "No."
Yeah, I also loved. He's like, "I have a life too, lady.
And 2 kids. Yeah. Single dad, 2 kids. And so I said, "Well, you know, I don't sleep that much. So you can call late if you want." And so I thought, oh, phew, dodged that bullet. Mm-hmm. But the nice guy did call. Mm-hmm. And we talked for an hour. And it turns out he was a nice guy. And he said, "Well, do you want to meet for lunch?" And I said, "Okay." And so we set up a date for lunch. And meanwhile, my friend is saying, "He's just a nice guy. He's just a nice guy. He's just a nice guy." And every time she said that, he got like shorter and uglier. And
that's another favorite part for me of this story.
In my imagination. And so I walk into the restaurant thinking I was 10 minutes early, not knowing then, as I do now, that Tim's chronically early. And I blow through the bar to go wash my hands in the ladies' room. And I see this cute guy sitting at the bar. Mm-hmm. And like the thought bubble above my head is, he's cute. I wonder where Tim is. And so then the cute guy at the bar turns around and says, "Charlotte." And then my thought bubble went, oh, shit. She didn't tell me he was good looking. She just said he was a nice guy.
I love how the assumption is he's got to be ugly.
Like she just kept saying.
So he's hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And then you're immediately getting, like, that was the thing I loved so much is when I was reading this, I could like feel your giddiness. And every time you were talking about the progression of your relationship or like when you were waiting for him to propose, I was like, oh my God, Charlotte's like 21 again. You know, you were just like, and to me, that is so beautiful to read because I feel like there's a period where a lot of people think I'm never even going to smile again, let alone be excited about another love interest.
Oh, I was so surprised. And, you know, Tim and Debbie, his first wife, they were high school sweethearts. Mm-hmm. So they met when they were 16 years old. So when she died at 41, they'd been together 25 years.
Insane. And you both had good, I mean, you were both happy in your marriages.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, one of the things I feel like I have this sort of like friendship with Debbie because I didn't know her. I never knew her, but I know her through Tim, through Debbie's parents. Mm-hmm. Through Debbie and Tim's children, who are now my children. Mm-hmm. I feel like she and I have this, I don't know, I feel like a friendship with her, even though I never knew her. And she had colon cancer, so she knew that she was dying. And she told him, you should find someone. And he said, I'm not going to. And she said, don't be an idiot. I think she might have even used some of Uncle Jose's colorful words when she told him. And I am so grateful that I don't know if he would have opened the door for himself.
From what I know about Tim, no way. No, he was loving her to the grave, baby.
Yes, yes. And so she was incredible in that way. And her parents were incredible in that way. When, spoiler alert, Tim and I did get married. And that's not where the book ends, though. And but when we got married, we had all eight of our parents.
Insane.
Both of my parents, both of Sam's parents, both of Tim's parents, and both of Debbie's parents. And like, what a gift to have been able to like scoop everyone up.
And a challenge.
And a challenge.
And I think that's what I love so much about the way you share your story. It's like there's happiness and, you know, beautiful things, but it wasn't like it was easy.
No.
And the thing that I thought, like, any parent needs to read this is, I mean, my favorite part was when you're saying to Tim, like, I just want to matter. I just want to be, you know, when am I going to be number two? And he's like, dude, you're number five. Like, there's like all these people above you, and you know that too. Like,
we used to joke that there were only four reasons why we would cancel on each other when we were dating, and they were our kids, Greg,
one, two,
Danny,
three, four.
Danny, and Jason. Yeah, because one of the other funny things is we had two Dannys, which makes life funny and
complicated.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if we lose our sense of humor, life, we're doomed. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes things are just funny, and yeah, sometimes things are hard and people have opinions and sometimes we will disappoint them.
Well, the weirdest thing about opinions is like, you couldn't have more conflicting feedback from people. Why did it take so long for you to fall in love again? Oh my God, you're already with someone? Like, it's constant and it's not consistent. So Correct. It's like, you got to live for you, dude. Who cares what all these people think?
Yes.
Screw these people. They're not living your life every day. But I did think that there was this really important balance between honoring your children, honoring your families before they merged. And there was this point where you and Tim wanted to go at different paces. And shocker, a therapist helped navigate through that. And I just want, if you can share like what your lesson was from that, because when I read that part of the book, it was still about taking care of and considering the kids, but not only considering the kids.
Yeah.
And I think that's a permission slip a lot of people might need.
Yeah. Well, we needed it because we did. Well, when you're a parent, you put the kids first, right?
If you're a good
one. As much as you can.
Yeah.
And it's important to put yourself on the list. Sometimes we forget. I think young parents are better now about putting themselves on the list than we were. And it's important because if you're not on the list, you can't continue to support them. That's the whole shtick for Sushi Tuesdays, was being able to support myself so that I could support them as well. And I mean, it was funny when after we got engaged, how many people said, oh, so all the kids agree? No, no, you have never seen such glum faces in the wake of an engagement announcement.
Saddest engagement announcement. That cracked me up too. Only I can just picture them. Yeah,
so we got engaged. We were all excited. So the first thing we do is we, you know, go to Tim's house and gather up all four kids. And we're like, okay, we thought we would be, and I think we are. I think they would all tell you that now. We'll be stronger for all four of you,
together.
The two of us together. Three of the kids were adamantly opposed, and the only Jason, the youngest, was excited, but he didn't want to show his excitement in front of everybody else. But even he, you know, was kind of waffling from time to time. So, you know, we were operating at a 12.5% approval rating at most times.
Yeah.
And we just had to live our way into the answer. And the therapist at the time, our oldest was about to start his senior year in high school. And so the therapist encouraged us to get married, because then our oldest would have a visceral understanding of what the home life was. Because even when they go off to college or do their next thing, the home is still provides a sturdiness and a structure. Mm. For them. And he was always very sort of kind and neutral. He's like, you know, she's a nice lady, Dad, but just do whatever you're going to do after I go away. And the therapist said, you know, once he let him experience what it is, so that he will know that he has a home to come home to, and he's very much a part of the family in its new configuration. And yeah, it's not what anyone thought it was going to be, but you know, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And we joke that we don't keep the skeletons in the closets. They're like Sam and Debbie's pictures are up on the piano and above the fireplace. And I mean, they're how we got here. Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful to be able to honor them in your current relationship. And I think it's a part of the healing process. Like, I truly believe that because you speak about them and involve them and mm-hmm. honor them, it is a better path forward for everyone. There isn't a right way to grieve, but I do think continuing to love them openly is a good starting point.
Absolutely. One of the kids, the Danny I didn't give birth to, it's like sort of the child of my heart. When he really needed me, he would talk about Debbie. Mm-hmm. And so that was the hook when he was talking about his mother. And so I would just listen. And he would tell me about his mother, and that was what he needed from me.
You kept showing up even when those kids were like GTFO.
Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. And the most visceral part that I pictured was when the older one comes home and he's like, you told my grandma she's never going to see me again. Just talk people through that experience, because I was reading it and I was like, oh, they're screwed. Like, she's gonna wanna wring this kid's neck and never give him another. I mean, you're your own human processing the emotion of these little people throwing things at you with vitriol, but you kept showing up and giving an opportunity for a good relationship and not holding them accountable for their emotions and their feelings.
Well, conflict is hard, and I think it's important to be able to like hold this space. So when the kids are little, it looks like breaking Legos. And when they're bigger, it sounds like you told my grandma that she would never see me again. And it was hard. Navigating the holidays was hard because we had four families worth of traditions. We had Christmas Eve, Christmas morning, Christmas dinner. And thank God we had one night of Hanukkah, because I don't know what we would have done otherwise.
Gosh.
And, the thing that I remember feeling in that particular moment that you mentioned was very protective of him. Because it's one thing when children act like children, it's another thing when grownups act like children.
And put them in the middle.
And so it was hard. My now husband, then husband Tim, and his father were sitting in the living room. hearing this shouting happening in the kitchen. And kudos to them for staying seated.
Big time.
Because that's hard.
But they got to let you figure it out, because if dad comes in every time.
And so, you know, we did our dance together. And what it came down to is Danny knows me. You know, I hadn't said what somebody had said I had said. And so it comes back to, like, you know who I am. You know how I show up. You know that I love you. I am still here. I'm not going anywhere. And a lot of it is, you know, all of these kids were abandoned.
Right, right.
Through no fault of their own. And so those feelings of abandonment are real. And I mean, this is why therapy is so helpful, because, you know, when the therapist can say to me, Charlotte, it really has nothing to do with you, has very little to do with you. You're just the grown up in the room. Sorry.
Right. But how freeing.
Like, okay, like, teach me how to be the grown up in the room, because I would kind of like to be the kid in the room sometimes. I have a fit of my own I'd like to throw. But understanding where that emotion is coming from and being able to say to him, if not in words, at least in actions, I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. You can be mad and I'm still not leaving. Mm-hmm. I'm here and I love you. Period.
Yep. Your kids are grown-ups now.
Yeah.
Like grown-up, grown-up. I really like keeping this centered around your experience. I don't want you, you know, speaking for how they are or where they're at. But I would like to share a little bit about the passing of time from your perspective, because I think you do a really beautiful job of showing that there is development and progress, but it doesn't mean that they're okay. Like, they're never going to be okay with the way that they lost their dad. That's never going to be, that's not the goal. That's not the goal. What can you share about what is working or what has been like a grounding force for you all as time has passed?
Well, I think it's important to think about grief as nonlinear. Mm. And sometimes it feels circular and sometimes it feels up and down. Like most of the parents I know, I wish I could protect them from everything. And I cannot. So all I can do is prepare them the best way I know. Mm-hmm. And all of my kids are really good at asking for help.
The best thing that came out of it all.
It's so hard to do. Love remembers. This is why grief continues, because love does remember, and that's important. And it's painful. And so sometimes I think it's still the same. I just try to show up for them the best I can.
Yeah.
And they are good, beautiful, young humans in the world, and I'm very proud of them. And they still struggle.
This is more talked about now than back then. There's still a very long way to go. What would you want to say to anyone who has already experienced the loss but has no vision of up, down, left, or right? What is something that maybe you needed to hear but didn't until you could say it to yourself? Like, so much has changed about these conversations since then.
I don't know. So where I always start is my little mantra was inhale, exhale, repeat as necessary. And in sort of like the Buddhist tradition, things are always changing. They are always evolving. And Jay and I were talking last night about it's never too late to begin your healing. Start where you are.
To close us out, I want to talk a little bit about just what life has been like since this has been put into the world, because I want anyone to read it who has been touched by suicide in any way, but I want everyone to read it because we are all one degree away. And this book is just like your human experience summed up by letting us watch, you know? And I would imagine so many conversations and connections and meetings have happened. But what do you feel like is the biggest change from when this came out to right now?
Well, it's pretty thrilling. Sometimes I still like, oh my gosh, I published a whole book.
Yeah.
And it's out in the world. Like, she makes her own journey out into the world.
Beautiful.
It never gets old to hear from somebody, you know, an email or whatever, that this book meant something to them. Because, you know, sometimes I think we write the books that we wish we'd had. And for me, that is a lot of what Sushi Tuesdays is about, and just sort of honoring what the journey is and knowing that everybody has their own journey within it. I feel like what I really wanted this book to do was to open up the conversation so other people feel welcome to share their experiences. And I feel like it really has.
It worked. Yes. And it's going to continue working. That's the thing that's so powerful about this, is it will continue to be a new thing that people discover that starts more conversations. You can buy it pretty much anywhere, but you also have a website that people can check out and learn more about your work. Yeah. Can you share with everyone where they can keep in touch with you?
Oh, the website is charlotte-maya.com.
I'm glad you kept it simple.
You can also still, sushitoesdays.com will take you to that website.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And I recorded the audiobook as well, so.
It's your voice.
It is my voice, which I think in memoir, I don't know, I just like memoirs that are, if the author can narrate it themselves,
yeah,
it's, I think,
way better.
That's better. Yeah.
Okay, I almost closed us, and then I remembered we have to talk about, essentially, from page one, you have this adorable dog that is so central to you and your boys navigating grief and everything that came after. And it's been years after Sam had passed. Your dog was kind of acting funny one morning, but he was like a young spry. Even though he was old, he was like, you know, young and energetic. And you went out for a run and came back and he was gone. And that was the first time you said that you had that physical, visceral, like moaning, sobbing, just, you finally felt like you were releasing what you had never released for Sam.
Yeah. Oh, well, first of all, I was alone in the house.
Yeah.
And
you had the space.
Yeah. And Parker wasn't that old. He was 9. But he was a breed that has heart issues. And so we knew he was struggling. In fact, I had a vet appointment for him. And Jay talked about the wail his father, the noise his father made in that deep grief. And I feel like it was like all the griefs, it was finally a space where I could just let all the griefs out. And there was a moment, at first I thought, oh, I need to call someone. And almost immediately I was like, I just need to let all of this out. And when I was recording the audiobook, there were two places where I had to re-record multiple times. And that was the hardest one to get through for this like dog. But it kind of, I feel like sometimes grief resonates in a specific key.
Yeah.
And Parker's death just touched on that key in a way that allowed me to just let all of that grief come through and out. But we kind of, sometimes we just don't know like what grenades are hiding in a drawer somewhere, right? You
totally
open up a drawer and there's a card from somebody,
right?
and it's like you're right there in that fresh grief. But there's something about our pets that just allows us to be more vulnerable and tender.
when I read that, what I thought was like, you can't make yourself grieve in that physical way, but giving yourself permission to do it can sometimes open that up. And my friend I was telling you about who had that delayed experience herself, she lost her mom. And then it was like 2 years later, her wallet was stolen. And that was when she felt like she finally let it all out. And since then, she has proactively used that knowledge to grieve in different ways. You know, she lost a friend, and collectively with a group of friends, when they went to honor her and everything, she said, I would love if we could all stand here and just scream. And they just screamed into Lake Michigan. And, you know, she said, not only have I never done that, like, I'm just going to go yell, but I had never done it with people. And she said, it felt so good. And I was just grateful that you shared that, because it's okay if it's delayed. You can't force it. But at the same time, you can try those types of things if that feels like that would feel good. Like going to a rage room and bashing a bunch of stuff. Like, you have to be okay with grieving in ways that don't feel normal, whatever the hell normal is.
Yeah, there's no checklist. No. Like, the stages of grief, that's a mess. They all blow in like a storm. They don't, like, it's not, there's not an outline. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? Check. No, that's not how it works. Right?
Yeah.
And I don't think they're just five stages either.
No.
Right? But denial shows up when you're least expecting it. And acceptance comes when it comes.
Yeah. Well, I am so glad that you're sharing, and you know, the progress that has been made around mental health knowledge is because of people sharing personal firsthand experiences. And I just feel hopeful for where we're going, the direction we're going in. And talking about suicide is so hard. And I want to say thank you for sharing your pain in a way that's helping so many people.
Well, I want to thank you for hosting this conversation, because it makes such a big difference. So thank you.
Thank you. Anything, final thoughts that you want to share, or anything I didn't give you a chance to?
The only thought that's sort of coming to me is that life is a team sport, right? We're not supposed to do this alone. And so I think your work really shows that. It's an example of, you know, life being a team project. And so thanks for being on the team with me.
Thank you. And anyone listening to this, please go listen to our conversation with you and Jay. It's so powerful to me to hear people who have lived through something and can tell you different perspectives, different feelings. And that's what we were able to do today. And I'm just so grateful for both of you sharing, having space for each other, and being honest about what it looks like for you.
Well, again, thank you very much.
Everyone, go read Sushi Tuesdays. I mean, honestly, if you just like memoirs, this is a good one. It doesn't have to be reading it for that, but the fact that we're having the conversation is amazing. So thank you.